are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 14th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ryan Signal on the gutting of net neutrality, which is happening right now. The FCC is in the process of creating a multi-tiered system which will slow down the internet and hurt independent media. We're going to talk about that and potentially how we can reverse this damage in the future. It's the five-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook massacre. And of course, record numbers of Americans support some very modest and seemingly commonsensical gun control legislation, even as the House passes a bill to allow concealed carry across state lines. You've probably been leaving comments, if you're watching or listening to this program, telling the FCC not to create a two-tiered slowdown internet. And there's probably very few normal Americans that would be commenting to the FCC in support of a big giveaway to Verizon, which is apparently why, according to the New York Attorney General, there have been about 2 million identities stolen to leave fake comments in support of the FCC changes. That's odd. And House and Senate leaders of the Republican Party have apparently agreed on the final form of a tax package, which will still look like a massive giveaway to the wealthiest Americans and also specifically devastate Puerto Rico's manufacturing sector. They're covering a lot of ends there. And CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, it's starting to run out of funds, and it's affecting states' abilities to implement the program now. Where did all that money go? Who knows? And Roy Moore, he is refusing to concede his loss. The Malls of Alabama brace as a upset, deranged man seeks comfort. No, he's not doing that yet. Apparently, he's just put out a fire and brimstone video talking about gay people, school brer, and a right of a man to claim to be a woman, and vice versa.
It's hard for him to count to 17, so all the ballots that were cast.
Fair enough. Roy Moore apparently is going to put a little bit more of a fight in, but the Republican Party, they seem to be ready to dispense of him. But please never forget that the national party and national leadership was content to have a almost certain child predator elected to the United States Senate just so they could go forward with their oligarch economic agenda. And, you know, what got lost in the pedophilia stories and the predation stories around Roy Moore was really just the sort of broader reality of him as just a absolutely horrible person who virulently anti-gay, opposed to transgender rights. Of course, as the tip of the iceberg, Muslims shouldn't be allowed to serve in Congress, according to Roy Moore. All manner of sort of bigoted extremist positions. And if it wasn't for the predator charges, he would have won. And the Republicans would have been quite happy to welcome him. And they were still happy to welcome him even after multiple credible women stepped forward with stories of him approaching them down to the age of 14. So just let that sink in, along with every story we do know about the current president and the many, many, many credible charges against him. It's pretty disgusting. But that was a genuine, I mean, Doug Jones is not going to be anybody here's favorite senator, but
take it where you can get it.
Take it where you can get it, and he's also not going to be the worst. I mean, right. I noticed that I haven't liked it. He's been hedging on getting seated to vote against that tax bill, which I do not like. But I also noticed one of the first tweets that he put out after his victory was that the Senate needed to get together and Congress needed to come together across party lines, blah, 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 and he will use those kind of tropes. But he said they needed to do it in order to make sure the CHIP was fully funded. So, great. There's an advocate for Tripp who prosecuted Klansmen, defeated a zealot predator with Stone Age politics. That's a good thing for America.
That unity talk is fine as long as it ends with put the money in the bag.
Exactly. I think we can all unify, and only a sociopath would not support funding children's health insurance. Oh, it's so weird that all the Republicans are sociopaths. Funny how that works out. Ajit Pai is the head of the FCC. He is the guy who is muscling through these changes that are happening right now, and we're going to talk about with Ryan Single in a few minutes. He went to the offices of the August Daily Caller, and I really would be curious to find out about, you know, who's advertising on the Daily Caller. Net neutrality is an issue that even in the right-wing grassroots, there isn't like a huge amount of enthusiasm for a giant Comcast Verizon giveaway. So he went to the Daily Caller. And I don't even know how to set this video up. This is one of the most sort of infuriating, stupid,
loathsome.
It is literally the worst of all possible worlds converging together in the form of a just sort of utterly contemptible propaganda video on behalf of creating a multi-tiered, slowed-down, corporatized internet. Here is Ajit Pai at the Daily Caller's offices doing a meme video to as a form of propaganda for destroying the internet. And pause it up.
I'm Ajit Pai.
If you're listening to this, the images are actually pretty self-explanatory. You won't get the full, utterly disgusting experience of watching this chowderhead do selfies and pretend to play with a lightsaber, but you'll get the grotesque idea. And if you want to really submerge into the depths, you can watch it on YouTube later.
I'm the chairman of the FCC. Recently, there's been quite a bit of conversation about my plan to restore internet freedom. Here are just a few of the things you'll still be able to do on the internet after these Obama-era regulations are repealed. You can still gram your food. Quality. Are you selfieing or just... You can still post photos of cute animals, like puppies.
Aww.
You can still shop for all your Christmas presents online. Yes, got that bulk deal on fidget spinners. Yes, those eclipse glasses are so cheap. You can still binge watch your favorite shows. You can still stay part of your favorite fan community. You can still drive memes right into the ground. And everything else you ever did on the internet. Like everything. All of it. All of it.
For more money and at slower speeds. And of course, none of this addresses independent journalism, hurting people that, as an example, exposed what was happening in Ferguson when the national press was not there. Great. It's a really, really overused phrase. But, you know, I mean, what else you got besides banality of evil for that? I mean, it was infuriating.
It's just funny to think back on like what historians will think about this, and they'll be like comparing it to the propaganda of like World War I, World War II.
Like the quality really went down.
They're like, yeah, they just kind of like fucked around on a green screen and didn't know how to mix audio properly.
Right.
Here's sriracha sauce. Ha ha ha.
Oh, Gene likes sriracha and spinners. Oh, he's so relatable. Jesus Christ. Are you always losing stuff? You losing your stuff? Matt? Like, Brendan?
Like patience? Oh, no, never mind.
Are you always losing your stuff? It stopped being cute years ago. Now you just annoy everyone who knows you, friends, family, coworkers, because you're that person who always loses stuff. Time for TrackR. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. Now they've done it again with an all-new Tracker Pixel. With Tracker Pixel, you'll never worry about losing your things again. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. Place Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose. Keys, wallets, purse. It's small enough to fit anywhere. When you misplace an item that has Tracker Pixel attached, use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It even has powerful LED lights so you can find anything, even in the dark.
Actually, I got a hard drive. I might put one of these on.
Boom. It's exactly what you should lose your phone. Just press a button on your Tracker Pixel and your phone rings even if it's on silent. That could have helped me in plenty of occasions. You can even locate your item if it's miles away because every Tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. It's like Waze for finding things. Tracker makes a great gift, and during this holiday season, save 20% off your order when you go to tracker.com/majority. When you go to thetracker.com/majority, that's the tracker, TRACKR.com/majority for 20% off. Tracker.com/majority. There's a link to it on the homepage as well. We'll be back in a moment. We're talking with Ryan Single about the overturning of net neutrality and what we can do about it. Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Ryan Single. He is a former reporter for Wired magazine. He's now a fellow at the Stanford Law School Center for Internet and Society. Ryan, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. You know, it's happening right now. The FCC, the Republican majority in the FCC, is moving forward to overturn net neutrality. I have no doubt that everybody listening to or watching this show probably has some sense of what net neutrality means and what the implications of it are. But maybe, you know, just sort of reset us again. What does net neutrality ensure for the internet?
Yeah, so net neutrality is a pretty simple principle. So it's the idea that we as Americans are the ones who get to choose what websites we want to visit, what apps we want to use, and what services we use on the internet, and that Comcast, Verizon, AT&T of the world should not make that decision for us, and that those companies should not interfere with the actual free market of the internet. It's been that way, you know, since the internet, internet's inception in the U.S. And this is a radical departure.
And what did the 2015 FCC guidelines under the Obama administration? What did they do? What did they ensure?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing I would say about the 2015 order is, you know, they didn't come out of nowhere. Before the 2015 order, there was a 2010 order. Before that, there was a 2004 policy statement. So the 2015 order built on sort of previous work by the FCC to keep ISPs from messing with our choices of what we do online, and put those orders on a very solid legal foundation. The rules specifically prohibited ISPs from blocking any legal content, website, or app. It prevented them from creating fast lanes or slow lanes. The fast lanes would be for something that would be paid, so companies would have to pay to be in the fast lane, and prevented a sort of unreasonable discrimination. So doing things like slowing down video traffic or things that could benefit the ISP's own services over other people's. So the other thing that they did is they also prevented, I think this is very important, they prevented ISPs from websites and services simply to have access to an ISP subscriber, right? Mm-hmm. So what the ISPs wanted was to be able to go to Yelp and say, hey, Yelp, nice website you got there. Why don't you give us, you know, $250,000 a month and we'll have your site load for our subscribers. Mm-hmm. These were good, strong, bright line rules, but I think it's just as important as what the order didn't do. People like to call these utility style regulations, and they're not. They're right. Common carrier regulations.
Right.
There's no rate regulation, right? Comcast will raise your rates without going to some authority to do that, right? And unlike, you know, your electric company, which actually has a, you know, almost always has some sort of board it has to go to justify its rate increases.
Right.
So, you know, the Obama administration struck a nice balance of let's make some solid rules that are legally defensible while also making it so that ISPs still had incentives to invest and startups, entrepreneurs could do, you know, could continue to launch companies and free speech would not be interfered with.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We'll sort of circle back to that. I'm certainly of the these things need to be regulated like utilities sort of school, but before we get there, I mean, so specifically, what is the Ajit Pai FCC doing to overturn those rules? And yeah, let's just keep going slow. What are they doing?
Yeah. This order is fairly radical. So
right.
Essentially, it gets rid of all of the FCC's rules against blocking fast lanes. Pay prioritization or charging websites for access.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we've had no blocking rules in the United States since it. You know, the first time they were enforced was 2004 by Republican Chairman Michael Powell. So getting rid of that. There is no longer a no-blocking rule. Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon can now decide to block websites for whatever reason they want, and including objectionable content. Mm-hmm. He's replacing those rules he's enhancing one of the, there was a, another rule in the 2015 sort of order, which required that ISPs be transparent with their customers about what they do. Right. So that stays. That's basically the only thing that stays. The FCC is also reclassifying broadband providers from common carriers to information services. And due to a number of court rulings in response to lawsuits from ISPs who didn't like this oversight, once they're in that category, the FCC literally can't put into those rules. So even if there becomes a problem with blocking, the FCC can't do anything. So they're kicking all this over to the Federal Trade Commission, which can only do two things. One, if an ISP tells you that they're not going to block services at all, and they do, then the FCC can go after them for violating their promise to you. But if it, you know, but when you if you sign up for, you know, Comcast and in the fine print it says, you know, we block objectionable content and you don't notice it, they can block whatever sites they want. The FCC can't do anything about that. The FCC can also go after some anti-competitive conduct by ISPs, which sounds nice, but anti-competitive conduct is very different in the FTC sort of parlance than it is the way most people think of it. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the FTC would be fine. They had a report in 2007 when, you know, sort of they thought they should be in charge of this, where they said they thought it'd be fine if Comcast or a Verizon, say, struck a deal with Skype and said, like, you know, Skype will be the exclusive VoIP provider for our subscribers, and all the other ones would be excluded. Mm. Because they really aren't in that business, right? They're not VoIP providers. Mm-hmm. That's not anti-competitive. So there's lots of things that ISPs can do that seemed that would just sort of, to, you know, most net neutrality violations would seem to Americans to be anti-competitive, but the FTC uses a kind of an economist kind of view that will allow quite a bit of misconduct.
So, okay, so I feel like there's sort of three other sort of broad sections to get to. One is, well, let's start with actually one sort of last question setting the table for how we've got here, and then we'll kind of get to what comes next and how we could potentially fight it. It seems like, and this is, you know, just definitely my read of politics and how policy is made in Washington, which is that it's, you know, it's very much a process that is totally dominated by corporate money. You know, not necessarily even always in a crude way, but just even in a way in terms of like what think tanks get funded, what, you know, just the process is utterly dominated by money. So the notion that, of course, public support and public pressure that the FCC experienced, even by the way, under the Obama administration, was significant. But I think also just as significant, if not much more significant, in fact, was that it seemed like net neutrality used to be a kind of like a site of an inter-corporate battle, which is that the ISPs and obviously, you know, these sort of like legacy, I would say monopolistic companies like Verizon, like Comcast, that really don't provide, I mean, they literally provide essential services, which of which they're totally under-regulated, but they're just, you know, they're controlling lanes and essentially just getting private sector taxes on the lanes, right? Like, it's a very kind of simple, crude business model. And they see in gutting net neutrality enormous new opportunities to essentially just sort of privatize commons and generate new profits out of it. You know, if I don't have to ensure equal lanes, there's a million different packages that I can slice and dice. And, you know, if we're being honest, I mean, maybe some of those things are even like, I don't know, maybe Netflix can figure it out. The NFL can figure it out. You know, they just signed some type of exorbitant, massive deal, I think, with Verizon for streaming. So, but the Googles, the Netflix, you know, the companies that sort of represent this Silicon Valley, the sort of new emerging empires of business, seemed like they were pretty strongly on the side of net neutrality. Where have they been in this fight. I mean, when I go and check my other show on Patreon, you know, Patreon certainly has a page thrown up. There's, you know, to sign a petition to preserve net neutrality. But I remember several years ago with what I think it was the SEPA, or, forgetting the name of the legislation, but I mean,
SOPA.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you know, Google, even with like the internet went dark, Wikipedia. I mean, this was those companies really flexed their muscles, and they have the kind of muscles that speak in Washington, which is money and influence. Where were they during this, and what does that mean for the future of their conduct in a post-net neutrality world?
Those are all great questions, and I love the lead up. So yes, you know, this is the broadband market is dysfunctional. 51% of Americans have only one choice of broadband providers, right? It's not getting any better, right? We're only seeing more consolidation there. To your point, yes, this order is really about one specific thing. ISPs have for a very long time looked at the internet and all the money that's made out there and all the companies that are flowing across their pipes to get to consumers and want to get at that money. Right. So in 2005, Ed Whitaker, CEO of SBC, put his foot in his mouth and said, the Googles, Yahoos of the world, like they're not going to get to use my pipes for free. Verizon in 2013 told a federal court that when it was suing over the 2010 rules, that it should have the right to charge any website any amount of money it wanted with no oversight over how much they asked, simply to get to users. And if that company didn't pay up, then Verizon could cut them off. And this is the one I love because this is kind of reasoning that only a telecom could come up with. That didn't count as blocking. Right? Blocking was only if you block someone on content grounds, right? So arbitrarily. They're like, we're totally fine with the no blocking rule, as long as we can also do this other thing, right? So it is all about ISPs. And in fact, like, that's the entire, I'm not exaggerating, because this is actually the sort of PI's rationale, which is that if we got rid of these rules and ISPs made more money, then they'd finally get us rural broadband. That's the plan.
That is unbelievable.
I mean, like, literally, if you read the order, this is the plan.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. And then coming back to your question, yes, early in this is a fight that's gone on for a very long time. Google used to be a huge player in, fighting for this. In 2008, it convinced the FCC to attach net neutrality rules to an auction of very valuable spectrum, like basically all the spectrum that's now used for 4G. Not all of it, but to one big slice that Verizon bought, and they attached net neutrality rules to it. And in order to do that, they had to guarantee that they would spend $4 billion to buy that spectrum if nobody else did. Google put a $4 billion bet on net neutrality in 2008.
Right.
They say a few things now, but let's be honest, like the Googles, Facebooks, Netflix of the world, they can all afford to pay off ISPs.
Yep.
Openness is the strategy of the startups, of the insurgents, right? So the ones who are fighting for this are exactly the Patreons of the world, like the Etsy's, right? The smaller companies, startups, and even the venture capitalists, because they want to build the next Google,
right?
So they're the ones who are telling the FCC that hey, this is bad. This is going to increase costs for startups because every startup's going to have to pay off just to load for Verizon or to be in the fast lane so they can be as fast as the incumbents. This plan is bad for innovation, for actual innovation. Because when the FCC says innovation, what they really mean is toll booth.
Right. Exactly. And that's exactly it. Like, people need to have that right. Anytime you hear innovation from Ajit Pai, you should just think of, going down the highway and stopping and throwing change at a toll booth. The only difference being, at least the change in that toll booth is actually doing something to benefit your trip. That actually is helping the road you're on. Maybe it's actually more analogous to sometimes I remember this As a friend of mine from Jamaica was talking about how, like, you go to, like, certain neighborhoods and, like, you know, sometimes, like, guys just pop out with, like, a machete and they're very friendly, but it's like, yeah, you got to pay the street tax. This is more analogous to what Verizon's doing. Okay. Let's then go into the sort of, like, depths of how bad this could get, and then we'll try to get to a note of hope. But first, let's get to how bad it is and how we can respond and deal with this assault by the AJPAI FCC. And it seems to me that, like, you know, the internet, far from being some type of, like, kind of weird sort of libertarian fantasy, is actually in some ways the perfect representation of a kind of balanced social democracy, in the sense that it is built on massive government funding and public sector investment. And then it created a space for both small-scale market innovation and startups and private sector activity, which of course helped build the internet, and then also commons and community-based, you know, outside of government and outside of private, genuine third sector kind of organic development. And that is big deal. Linux, Wikipedia, and also even a lot of the models that companies have innovated on top of, whether they be Google or IBM. And in that system, you know, things like government regulation and net neutrality, and obviously we're going to need to start looking into the big four, in my view, and sort of anti-monopoly politics. If you strip that away, and what we're doing with the FCC is going to make it more just like kind of insurgency protection, monopoly protection, and the content is going to look more like cable news. And we got to think about, you know, who do we have to protect here? We have to protect consumers who are going to get hurt by this. We have to protect the startup and innovation community. And we also need to protect the, you know, independent voices, journalism, and, you know, online, you know, decentralized communities, essentially. So what are the lanes that, like, first of all, how is it going to hit us? And then what can be done in the next couple of years to try to minimize the damage? Do we have to start going directly to corporations themselves to the extent we have any possible purchasing power? Like, what does it look like?
Yeah. So, you know, this is the thing. Like, when this order goes into effect, which, you know, probably sometime in December, maybe a bit longer, just depends. It has to be published in the Federal Register. You know, the internet's not going to change the next day. You know, ISPs aren't going to come out with, like, crazy looking cable package plans, like, immediately, right? Like, these folks are smart, right? Like, you know, and they can see that, like, you know, I think the Washington Post poll the other day was something like 85% of Americans, supported keeping the existing net neutrality protections, and you know, three out of every four Republican agreed with keeping the protections, right?
Right.
So, I think you're going to see first is there going to be there's ways for them to start to charge providers more money, right? That may not be very visible, right? So, for instance, you know, lots of companies, you know, they pay their web hosting provider to be online, and that web hosting provider pays three or four middlemen, right? These sort of middle mile providers, level three, Cogent, which then deliver those to the various broadband, you know, sort of subscriber networks around the United States and around the world. So, so what we'll probably see, and this is what we saw Comcast and the top six ISPs do in 2013, is try and get those people to pay them money. Right. So they did this in 2013, trying to figure out how to get Netflix to pay them money, even though Netflix isn't dumping traffic onto their network. They're sending traffic that Comcast subscribers are paying them or paying Comcast to deliver.
Right.
So there's sort of insidious ways. And so that works its way back up the chain. Right. So if you're the middle mile provider starts to, like, have to pay Comcast and Verizon a significant chunk of money. Right. So when this happened in 2013, one of those level three said that, like, one of those companies, I think it was AT&T, wanted to have level three pay it as much money as level three was already paying to get to all of the internet already. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, every ISP just keeps raising that price, but then they have to charge that to the web host, and then the web host has to charge that to the company. Right. And so then every company's cost to be online goes up. And then every service, you know, so then you're going to get fewer free services because it's more expensive to offer free services. Paid services will become more expensive. The cool, cheap, fun side projects become more expensive, right? Mm-hmm. So the way I kind of think of it is like the internet's going to become more boring and less weird and less democratic. That's the first thing you're going to see. And then we'll see some ways that they're going to try and charge individuals, right? You know, and they might do it as like 4K video comes along, right? Like you're going to have to get a 4K video package. You know, it's going to be the slow boil. But it's upending that, changing that payment model upends the entire way the internet has worked for 30 years and actually starts to take us back to like an old bad payment model, right? And remember, you know, like that still exists. So like, you know, if you use a regular landline phone and try to place a, you know, a long distance call to, you know, say India, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to cost you $2 a minute.
Right.
That's not because it's an expensive phone call. It's because India has a telecom authority who set the rules to say like any, you know, any incoming long distance call, you know, is $1.50 per minute.
Right.
You have to pay us.
Right.
So then all of a sudden, like you start to get to that point where everything's expensive again. Whether the amazing thing about the internet is that it's cheap to get online. It's cheap to run a blog. It's cheap for somebody to create a company that will let you make a blog for free.
Or for that matter, collaborate globally. Like, I mean, I worked briefly at a, you know, when I was out of college, I worked for a strategy and consulting company, but we worked like, there was a concentration of people in the Bay Area, but I was in New York and there were, you know, people in India and there were people in Colorado and, you know, we could synchronize team meetings and do projects we needed to do on all of these platforms like Skype and, you know, all of these other sort of, you know, these barriers were not barriers.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like the come for all sorts of things, whether that's like you're a, you know, a nonprofit and then you're like all your communication tools are now, you know, price of zero, right? You know, you're trying to get the word out about something or you just like want to, you know, have people find you. You just, you know, you can start a free blog. It's pretty easy. I worked at Wired for 10 years and then I had an idea to how to make recommendations for publishers better. So I started working on it and, you know, the first month cost us $20. A year later when I left Wired to run it full time, like we had paying customers, we were doing great stuff. Our cost to run the entire like service, right, was like $285, right? You can do this and like, you know, that's the same for everybody. And I mean, like, it's not like, if you raise these prices, investors are going to, you know, pay for it. You know, Facebook's, you know, had, their server cost was $85 a month when they started and they didn't get money for like funding until they had 250,000 users. Right. So it's, we're going to hurt all sectors of the internet, right? From the, you know, from people doing organizing to, you know, people that just want to be heard and like, you know, run a cooking blog, right? You know, would-be entrepreneurs to small businesses, right? So like, you know, every business now relies on the internet. You know, I was talking with a guy who runs a vaping shop in Colorado, right? And when his internet cable got, you know, connection got cut with some guys doing construction down the street, his business ground to a halt because, you know, it was all of his inventory management software, right? All the payroll software, right? Like everything, you know, the payments. So if you increase the costs, it's not just to like the startups or the big companies, like it's to every sector of the U.S. economy. Like this is a radical bad change.
So what is to be done in this? I mean, I want to get to like, hopefully some, you know, Bernie Sanders is president in 2020, you know, like what does an FCC do to overturn this? Right. But in the next couple of years, like what is the, can cities do their own plan? You know, can state on a state level, what like is their consumer power? Like what, is there anything that can be sort of done here?
Great question.
Yeah.
On the consumer level, I'm going to call that the citizen level. Keep calling Congress.
Yes.
This works. Like Congress is feeling the heat this morning. the first Republican senator, right, to broke with the plan. So
Susan Collins
late,
broke today, right?
Susan Collins came out and called in a really strong letter. Like I was really kind of blown away. She basically said, like, this is bad for the economy. Keep the protections. This is going to hurt rural broadband providers. Like, this whole process was rushed. Like, halt the vote. Like,
right.
That's awesome, right? It's just very clear this is a nonpartisan issue.
Right.
And folks in Congress are hearing that. Their phones have been melting just through Battle for the Net alone, battleforthenet.com, which is kind of the...
We'll have the link again on our homepage, battleforthenet.com. Yeah. Light up the phones today, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, 800,000 calls to Congress since this order was dropped the day before Thanksgiving, right? So, like... we saw Representative Mike Kaufman, a Republican in Colorado. He came out earlier this week, also called for that for the vote to be halted. So Congress oversees the FCC. They can put pressure on them. And 2018 midterms are coming up, right? This is going to be in play there. Don't let them think like it's done and gone, and that it was okay that if you're represented by a Republican legislator, that they sat by and didn't say anything.
Yep.
They know this is a bad plan, right? I mean, literally, they know this is a bad plan. And, you know, so far that even today, Marsha Blackburn, who's, one of the Republicans most in the pocket of telecoms, came out and said, oh, well, we'll do some legislation, right? Like, interesting.
Sure. Just like they did with when they gutted the Voting Rights Act. Congress swooped in and fixed what the Supreme Court did. Yep. Totally.
Yeah.
Sure.
It was pretty clear this was a 1-2 punch. Like, first, let's create a crisis, and then we'll write some crappy legislation. But,
right.
Cities and statewide. So I would bet in the next couple of days we're going to see states coming in to try and put in their own net neutrality protections. The FCC order tried to preempt that, but it's not clear that legally they can do that. They could preempt states when they called when broadband providers were common carriers, but because they took them out of that designation, the states are free to regulate internet, like sort of information services. So we could see state level pushes. We saw that happen in California recently, where California almost got through a really great privacy law about ISPs.
Mm-hmm.
Cities and states can do other things too. Like, you can do things to promote broadband deployment. And I think we've seen some great stuff around municipal fiber development, because there have been success stories. Chattanooga built itself a great network. Now when you land in the airport, right, in Chattanooga, the sign, they call themselves the Gig City, right, or the Gigabit City. We've seen lots of places in Colorado that are voting to look into this. And, there was in Fort Collins, and the ISPs hate this. In Fort Collins, they were putting a referendum basically said, we're going to talk about this, right? Because ISPs got the state to pass a law where even for municipalities to consider something, they had to pass, like they had to pass a referendum. Comcast and Charter through corporate front groups spent $500,000 to beat that versus $10,000 by the local folks, and it passed. So Fort Collins hasn't built anything yet, but there's been some really there's some really good ways, and it makes sense. And so, like, it doesn't even have to be that the cities run the networks. So it was an interesting case recently, or an interesting network built recently where the city built all the infrastructure, and then let any ISP that wanted to rent their services, and built it in a way that literally you could change ISPs like on a web page. Like, you could, like, within 15 seconds be like, I'm tired of this service, I'm going to go to these guys.
Wow.
Right? And you would have,
great.
So it's like, oh, great, right? Okay, you can have fantastic fast internet connections, and you can switch ISPs. Like, I would love to see that. So I think that's a great thing, because municipal networks work really well. They save cities money over the long term. The problem is it's expensive, and this is the reason we don't have much competition, is it's really expensive to build a network, and you have to think of it like infrastructure that it's going to pay itself off over time,
right?
It's going to take 7 or 10 years, right? But
right.
The way I like to think of it is, like, nobody ever complains about the cost of the Golden Gate Bridge, right? Nobody even knows right. how much that cost.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So,
You know, so then as a final, I mean, I'm going to go a little bit broader here, but, you know, you can keep it as focused as you want. But it does strike me that, say, in 20, you know, yes. And first of all, you're absolutely right. Make this a key issue in 2018. But say in 2020, somebody's elected. And this, in fact, you know, I mean, even beyond my sort of, you know, preference of a, you know, real kind of genuine left candidate, this is one of these issues, and people should know this. And one of the, you know, this is one of those margins of like why you vote for a Hillary over a Trump. You know, this is a, even some of the more kind of mediocre elected Democrats are going to be just better on pure average on this issue than Republicans. If Democrats take back control in 2020, or potentially even legislatively after 2018, but I guess looking forward. Let's go to 2020 because I want to know what a Democratic FCC could do to overturn this and kind of save the internet from the ISPs again. And then maybe if you could less specifically, but speak to it, it just strikes me that sort of net neutrality is the tip of an iceberg of a whole set of questions that we do not have a 21st century consumer protection network and government power and citizenship engagement that is in any way commensurate with the power of technology in our lives. Everything from the future of privacy to medical discrimination to, in fact, the reality that, you know, your internet connection and your cell phone, like, those are utilities, and they're still regulated and treated, you know, like accessories or information services when they absolutely are not. They're sort of embedded into our lives in a way that, you know, is like your phone when we needed to break up Ma Bell. And then, of course, you know, the big four sort of dominating the next wave of the internet economy. So I guess specifically on net neutrality, what can be done in 2020, and could this be used as the tip of a spear to look more broadly at how we're going to generate the type of broad, aggressive policy frameworks so that there's actually democratic accountability and protection from just sort of like unbelievable corporate and technological power moving forward?
Yeah, good question. So I think one of the shames of this, you know, the 2016 election, you know, there are many of them, but I'm specifically focusing on net neutrality, is, you know, we got really good rules in 2015. Like the 2010 rules were okay, but the 2015 rules were solid, and it would put on a solid legal foundation. Like, you know, every time previously the FCC had like tried all these little tricks to like say, like, we're deregulating ISPs, but we have rules, and ISPs just like sued them over and over. Like, you can't stop us from blocking BitTorrent.
Right.
You can't. We finally got to defensible rules. Like, the 2015 rules got challenged in court twice, and the court just like sent the telecoms packing. Like, this is solid, good law. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And if that had been able to stay in effect, I think for, you know, we had 2 years, right? Or if we had 5 years, right? Or 4 years, right? The arguments that are being marshaled against this, that, you know, ISPs aren't going to innovate in their, you know, invest in their networks and, you know, and this is harming innovation, would have just been gone. And it would have, like, served as a really good model of how to start to think about these kinds of questions, right? The sort of bigger questions. And instead, we're now having to like waste a lot of energy to relitigate, you know, what was a fairly smart, measured decision in 2015. And this issue gets muddied a little bit because, you know, now, you know, the Google and Facebooks of the world, not to mention like Amazon,
right.
Like, you know, those folks have been looking, you know, starting to look problematic for a long time. You know, they were services that, you know, I covered a lot of privacy issues, when I was at Wired, and, you know, they, you know, They worried the hell out of me, and they made some really bad decisions. And their motives are, you know, generally not to be trusted.
Yep, of course.
And they've just gotten bigger, right? And then it was thing at some point, like, it was like Google started, like, launched a DNS service. I'm just like, why are you guys even in that business? Like, why are you in all of these businesses? And, you know, their market power just keeps getting bigger. And those are real concerns. They're, you know, they're really not net neutrality concerns, but they are... they get to that. Your bigger question is like, what's the regulatory model for dealing with all of these questions? You know, and then the question like, you know, I don't know, what do we do with all the robots? Do the robots get all the jobs?
Right.
So, and, you know, I don't have an answer for that. You know, what I guess, you know, I'm just kind of a little bit just sad that we'd like, you know, we had what I think was kind of a good, interesting model where you had some bright rules but allowed innovation while constraining the bad actors.
Right.
And we could prove that it would work. Then, oh, okay, like, well, maybe this could work in a kind of a consumer protection thing for so for privacy, right?
Right.
Or for dealing with you know, I think antitrust is its own thing. Like, you know, we have to, there's lots of people rethinking how we did, you know, we decided to do antitrust starting in the late 70s with just focus on like, you know, short-term thinking about like what's good for consumers rather than what's good for you know, all of us long term. So I don't have a good answer there, but I think it's something that I think increasingly, like, you know, the internet is not a niche is like issue anymore. It's not something for geeks. Like, it's part of everything we do, right? From how we date to, you know, to our jobs, to how we talk to our parents, to, you know, to everything. I definitely think, but I don't have a good answer for you, Michael. I wish
But these are, I mean, at the very least, this is how I think we need to start, you know, but everything you just framed for us is exactly what we need to start thinking. And just the bottom line that, like, you know, a sort of an infantile kind of libertarianism or essentially just new version of, you know, the same way the oil companies dominate the policy process or pharma. I mean, that's destructive and dysfunctional and bad enough for democracy and inequality, let alone, you know, it's just, to me, the fundamental lack of alignment between an industry and a pace of innovation. And this is fully off of net neutrality, maybe for future conversations, but, like, you know, yes, like creating the future, you know, what did Elon Musk say something about how, like, you know, we're a couple years off, you know, like robots are going to move so fast, they won't even be sort of like visually perceptible. Robot workforces. I mean, this stuff is actually real. And there's an unbelievable amount of capital, human ingenuity, and sense of possibility, which is completely misaligned. Like, these are people that are not thinking like, yeah, let's just eliminate driving as an industry. Great. Okay. Well, what happens then? And I mean, besides a few incredibly rudimentary and dull conversations and, you know, about some kind of limited version of UBI, I don't get the sense that any of these people are thinking seriously. And partially it's because, you know, it's not their job, but, you know, we as a society need to, like, technologists are great, but we also need policymakers and ethicists and union leaders and activists and think about all the different facets of human life and how they're governed and protected and not just sort of thrown into some, you know, sort of like teenager fantasy about robots. You know, I mean, what can I say?
Preach.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Very last question, unless you also want to preach too. But we just saw, I don't know if you saw this just dreary and contemptible and disgusting propaganda video of Ajit Pai for Daily Caller, showing that you can still do all the things that, and of course, just the depressing, you know, like, the only thing you use the internet for, of course, is to take pictures of sriracha on Instagram. Of course, you wouldn't get it to, you know, get information or anything or build community or, you know, get cheaper tickets to fly to a new place or, you know, all of the really exciting things about the internet. Is this like the best talking point they got? You still get to share selfies?
You know, this is the thing. It was, you know, really sad about this debate. Like, Like, it was like there was not a single public hearing, right? There was not a, like there wasn't even like there was no hearing that had experts involved. You know, they didn't want to talk about the issues, like, you know, like, you know, the commission, the chairman, like, started to, like, get into fights with, like, a Melissa Milano on Twitter. And, like, there was just no, like, actual policy debate. It was just essentially we'll throw around the words, like, Obama-era utility regulations, and then we're done.
Right.
And, you know, so the cuteness, like, you know, I've seen him speak. I've never met the man. He's charming, right?
Not to me.
But, right. Yeah. You know, he's, you know, like generally he's not as funny as he thinks he is, but you know what, like, you know, he's got a good stage presence. Right. But like, even in the event I saw him out, like he just wouldn't talk policy, which is basically, oh, we haven't decided, made up our minds yet. And there just hasn't been any substantive policy debate here. Like, and I'm, you know, it's not like, you know, like even in like 2008, when the FCC chair, who was a Republican as well, Kevin Martin, he was trying to crack down on Comcast for blocking peer-to-peer.
Right.
He held multiple public hearings, right? He did that in, like, I think it was like there was one on the East Coast at, like, Harvard and one out at Stanford. Huge comment period, like, really thoughtful, like, long, like, debate. And, like, that was just for, like, whether or not you were going to sanction a company for blocking a site. And you know, went on fact-finding. And, like, this was just a sham. And so, you know, it just seems to me that, like, the sort of the performativeness of, like, you know, reading mean tweets and whatever, like, we're substituting, you know, like, social network performances for actual policy debates. And, like, that's just as disturbing to me, like, the process as the content, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's going on and doing that on Daily Caller. In the meantime, the, like, FCC comment system was overrun by bots that, like, committed identity theft. The New York Attorney General is trying to look into it, and his agency doesn't want to help. Like, they don't even want to look into it. Right. I'm like, really? That's what we got? Like, that's sad.
It's,
you know,
disgusting,
I mean,
yeah.
But, yeah, we're also seeing some conservatives break out. There was a great piece in National Interest yesterday that was, like, just like, hey, this is crony capitalism.
Right.
It's like, oh, ouch.
Right.
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 You know, so Breitbart is writing strong stories about net neutrality now. And I talked with guns.com the other day and, you know, talk about why gun owners might be worried about
that. I like the self-explanatory guns.com.
Yeah.
I dig it. I like the name of that website. Yeah. Well, I can do is think of my Trump though and be like, yeah, social media performance under policy, over policy. I wonder where that came from, Ryan. Yeah. Seems like it's working out. Yeah.
You know, but people are like, people get it. Like, and especially this is the internet. This is theirs. You know, they take this really personally. And I think the Republican Party made a very big mistake. And I think this is going to be one of the things that comes back and hits them hard in the midterms.
Well, let's make that so. Ryan Singel, I really appreciate your time. He's a former reporter at Wired. He's currently a fellow at Stanford Law's Center for the Internet and Society. And I really would like to underline society in the part of that title. Ryan, thank you so much for your work. I appreciate it and look forward to talking with you again in the future.
Michael, thanks for having me on. This was really fun.
Take care, man. Okay, folks, we are going to go to the... In the new Skype system, they always ask you for a review of the call, which is annoying. Always leads me, I'm always tempted to leave like a 3-star review.
That is Silicon Valley asking for free labor from its users.
That's literally what it is. I remember one time I got into a conversation probably like in 2011 or something. And it was such bizarre framing because I this was the first moment, and it was because I had done some work in the periphery of Silicon Valley. I'm definitely not a tech person, obviously, but I was working for a firm that did a lot of tech stuff, and we were building out some research and strategy around it. And so I was, you know, I was involved in conversations and people who were pre-thinking stuff that wasn't on people's radar, like Facebook and privacy. Like, Facebook is essentially just this sort of giant data mining company you know, masquerading as a friend network in the sense of that's literally how their business model works. And I somehow this came up at some dinner or something. I don't know. I just kind of mentioned it in passing. And I remember this woman was like, Facebook gives you a service for free. How dare you criticize how you make money? And she and I was like, man, like the propaganda of this culture is stunning. Because I was like, we need to start having a conversation about some of the like future most powerful companies in the world, already incredibly high capital value companies that are determining information flows, how we view social status. We need to start having a little bit of critical assessment of them. And her thing was like, you get to be friends with people for free and you're not like, you should be writing Mark Zuckerberg a letter. I was just like, wow, this is, I mean, it really was like, you know, those kind of like the Norman Mailer, like it was in some ways it was a little glib, but he had that thing where he said, you know, he went to the Soviet Union in the 80s and he said, like, the Soviet Union is overtly oppressive and obviously. And then he met like a handful of dissidents and he had never met people in his life that were more free. And then in America, nobody was free, but they just didn't notice. And I mean, it was kind of a creative license there, but I took his point. He was making a point of sort of like, you know, cultural commodification and consumerism as its own sort of form of servitude. And when I heard her comment, I was like, well, there it is.
Back
is Norman Mailer right there.
It hasn't changed. 100 years ago when H.G. Wells was writing War of the Worlds, a sort of a low-key anti-imperialist tract,
right.
This guy, Garrett P. Service, wrote a counter narrative, Edison's Conquest of Mars, where Thomas Edison used his techno-like skills. Basically, he was a proto-Elon Musk and saved the world from the aliens who are the real aggressors. So,
oh, thank you. Thank you. Elon Musk really irritates me. Probably have to get into him on the Michael Brooks show. Become a member of the Majority Report. That's how we keep the ship sailing. As always, thank each and every one of you for making it happen. True, independent, unbought, unbossed media. Check out Majority Report Kickback, which has doorways for you that you might find useful to your online shopping experience. What
portals.
Else? Portals to help with connectivity. Number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. This was another great... next week is going to be the 20th episode of the Michael Brooks Show, talking with the really legendary academic Adolf Reed, and then Will Menaker is going to join me in studio, along with, of course, super producer Matt Leck. We're close to our next goal of 900 patrons. Check it out. And as part of the Illicit History series, which is usually like uncovering like the Bolivian drug cartels and the CIA or the secret history of Corey Pine of Silicon Valley fascism. There's a lot of meat to it. We're developing a teleplay on the secret biography of Nation of Islam Obama. And some of that is going to be under the Illicit History vertical and behind the paywall. So if you haven't yet, check out the Michael Brooks Show. Either if you want to get the whole thing on Patreon, what are you waiting for? Or if you're just checking out, watch it on YouTube channel, Michael Brooks Show, on this YouTube channel, or check it out, Michael Brooks Show in iTunes. I think we're at like over 170 something reviews or something on iTunes, and they're mostly all very nice. Appreciate all of you. A ton to get to in the fun half with me, Brendan, and Matt. Just wanna degrade the white man. Exactly.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them, fuck them, fuck them,
fuck them, fuck them, fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Pussy.
Welcome back. Welcome to the fun half.